In this special edition of The 21st, we're focusing on the ripple effect of the presidential election.
For those of us who study European politics, although I wouldn't say that we saw this necessarily coming, in the back of our minds, we always had the Brexit vote, because that was another case of an election where experts thought that the Remain campaign would win, and then all of a sudden we got a very different result.
That's the University of Illinois' Kortis Kortakakis answering the question, is this our American Brexit? And what does a Trump presidency mean for European and global economies and politics?
We have seen changes in governments in the U.S. Governments have changed also in Europe. And that doesn't alter the nature of our friendship and partnership with the American people.
That's the European Union's Valerie Wuchsel-Laxton. She was also part of an event we recorded last week with the University of Illinois' European Union Center. It's a special broadcast of The 21st This Hour. Stay tuned. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a special broadcast of the program for you today. Last week, 2 days after the election, I moderated a panel for the University of Illinois' European Union Center. The topic was how much our American election will impact not just European relations, but the global economy. In short, was last week's election our American Brexit? And if so, what does it mean not just for us, but the rest of the world? It was recorded in front of an audience at the Illini Union with a panel of foreign policy experts and questions from our audience.
Americans have elected their first president with no prior political or military experience, and Donald Trump will be soon the 45th president of the United States. As our country and the world reacts to this news today, we thought we would talk about how this will affect not just transatlantic relations, but future elections upcoming in Europe, our economy here in the U.S. And I think the reaction of two European leaders was very telling as to how many people, especially those outside the United States, are feeling. UK Prime Minister Theresa May offered a boilerplate sentiment congratulating Donald Trump, adding that the US and the UK have a special relationship and that she looked forward to working with them. And I should add, I got another email this afternoon from the British Embassy talking about a very cordial call that they had earlier today. And German Chancellor Angela Merkel had simply this to say: Germany and America are connected by values of democracy, freedom, and respect for the law and dignity of man, independent of origin, skin color, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or political views, she said, adding, I offer the next president of the United States close cooperation on the basis of these values. So we know it's not just the U.S. establishment that's reeling from this, and half of the country, I should say, but also much of the world. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Is this our American Brexit? What does this mean not just for American, but European and global economies? And what about all the political ramifications of this? We want to start with our panel here on stage, a group well-suited to discuss these immediate implications, what we know and what we don't know going forward, because I think that's an important part of this discussion as well. Our guests today are Valerie Wuchsel-Laxton, Head of Economic and Financial Affairs for the Delegation of the European Union to the United States in Washington, Kostas Kortakakis, an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, and Shamira Gelbman, who's an Associate Professor of Political Science at Wabash College in Indiana. Thank you guys for being here. Shamira, can I start with you, with your immediate reaction? Did you expect Donald Trump to win the presidency?
I did not. So I study American politics and have been teaching a course on election polling this semester. And so I've been following polls fairly closely. And for the most part, this didn't seem to be coming. If you look at political science chatter today, there's a lot of, well, we were in the margin of error, just in the wrong direction. There's some talk like that. But I think if you had asked anyone the morning of Election Day, anyone who's been following the polls on the morning of Election Day, what's going to happen tonight, I don't think anyone would have said, well, Trump's going to win, and he's going to win all of these states. I was definitely surprised. There were early signs in the evening. The down-ballot races in Indiana, I think, were a signal that maybe I should have taken more seriously than I did early in the evening. But then it gradually became clearer and clearer And it took a while, but then it became clear that there was no path for Clinton to win.
Valerie, I'm going to put you on the spot because you just came from Washington. So I'm curious what the Washington establishment, the foreign sort of the diplomats, the core of people who are working on foreign policy, what's the tone in Washington right now?
Well, you know, I left Washington last night, so
there you go. It's a good sign.
It's very early days, and the little I picked up was indeed to echo the previous speaker was this sense of surprise. I think everybody was looking at the polls, maybe very closely, maybe too closely, and we were quite surprised in the results. Yet it was a very clear result in the end, and the American people have chosen their new president, and the immediate reaction is really to come in Washington to go and see the people who are working closely with him and to understand exactly and specifically the details of the policies he'll be working on. And that's really our attitude to it. We have a very strong relationship with the U.S., being the EU, and it's very important to us. It's a strong and deep relationship, which we are going to continue working on. So the immediate reaction is to go out there and meet our counterparts and the people who are working with the president-elect to work together on strengthening this relationship.
Mm-hmm. Kostas, Valerie said a clear result, but not if you look at the popular vote. Certainly a clear result according to Electoral College. And I know for my family in Europe, I've spent a lot of time explaining the Electoral College in the past, not just this year, but in previous years when this has happened. I wonder what you think the reaction has been in Europe, what you're seeing. I'm curious what you've heard from folks.
First of all, I'd like to say in relation to the reaction of the experts, I think this has become part of the story, actually. The fact that the experts are surprised, that's part of the story of this election. So how they were taken by surprise by the result. Although I have to say that for those of us who study European politics, although I wouldn't say that we saw this necessarily coming, in the back of our minds, we always had the Brexit vote, because that was another case of an election where experts thought that the Remain campaign would win, and then all of a sudden we got a very different result. And so I think I can speak for myself and people I know in Europe, political science professors that I had been in communication with during the campaign, who thought, well, okay, all the data show that Hillary Clinton is the favorite to win, but is this going to be another case of the Brexit vote? And I think for a lot of experts on Europe, this was not a completely unfathomable possibility.
So would you say this is our American Brexit?
I don't know what you mean by this question, because I think Brexit was, this referendum was about a very clear question about whether the United Kingdom would get out of the European Union or not. And I don't think that this is, there is a comparable question in this case. What I think is comparable is how the electorate reacts to a similar question. And I think the question in both cases, and so that's where I see a similarity there, is how much do they want their country to be engaged with other countries, and not just how much, but also in what way.
By that I mean a couple things about the establishment not recognizing it, about a popular sentiment and feelings of maybe anti-globalization, of maybe countries turning inward. Shamira, I wonder if you can just speak to the missteps in polling and how much you think that, both in the UK and here in the US, was a complete lack of recognition of how, both in the UK and the US, half the country was feeling.
Yeah, polling is always challenging, right? You're basically trying to grab a small piece of the population and generalize from that to a large, diverse country. And we rely still very much on techniques that were developed in the 20th century in a very different communications context, a different demographic context. And so I think pollsters for the last decade or so have been kind of coming to terms with the challenges of a population that doesn't answer the phone anymore, right? They kind of had to deal with cell phones, and they sort of figured that out, but didn't really account for the fact that people don't answer cell phones the way they used to answer landlines back in 1985, right? I think part of the problem is just the technology of public opinion polling hasn't quite caught up to the way people work, right? The way people interact with each other. And I think it's been a vicious cycle with the public increasingly skeptical of polls, tired of polls. There's a lot of fatigue. People don't answer the phone when they know it's a pollster or find a way to hang up in the middle of the call. And the more the polls are wrong, the more people are likely to do that. And so I think there's going to be kind of a big moment of reckoning for pollsters after this year's Brexit vote and now the U.S. presidential election. There will be a little bit of, well, we were somewhat close, right? Some of that conversation. But I think also, what do we do next time, right? How do we approach polling, and at what point do we kind of hang it up in 2018, 2020?
Mm-hmm. Costas, I wonder how much you think this is a reflection of, I know you've done a lot of research on sort of new social groups, that we may be a new recognition of the way people are looking at engagement within not just their country, but the world and the global economy. How much do you think that this, what we think about, I mean, I think when we think about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders both representing two different revolutions in a way, that are very anti-establishment, that are very different economic conversations than we've had in the past at least decade or so. Do you think that that's part of this conversation also, that we haven't had enough?
I think people's interests have changed, and what they're sensitive to has changed. And so that globalization is one of the reasons why people think differently, and they're willing to vote for different parties and different candidates than they used to in the past. So we tend to think of the electorate in this classic left-to-right dimension, where you have working class on the left, the middle class in the middle, and then part of the middle class and the upper class on the right. And so we tend to think, let's say in the case of the United States, but also in most countries of the world, we think of, you know, parties of the left as having part of the middle class and the working class, parties of the right, part of the middle class and the upper class. And that's how we understand politics in the world. But I think what has been happening is, because of globalization, we see part of the people who were voting for left-wing parties and part of the people who voted for right-wing parties, they now are voting together against globalization, and some of those traditional constituents of left-wing parties and right-wing parties, they're favoring globalization. So I think the new division in society is not between left and right as we understand it. It's between people who are pro-globalization and anti-globalization. And so I think what Donald Trump did, and I think some of the Brexit campaigners did that were successful, is that they were able to understand that the electorate has changed, that the divisions in society have changed, and so that it contributed to their success.
Mm-hmm. Costas, you were talking about sort of the economic anti-globalization forces, but I also wonder how much we see, and I don't know if you would, and Shamir, I'd love to have you weigh in on this also, how much we see a reflection of European nationalism. And I'm thinking about even the congratulations that we saw to Donald Trump, obviously from France's far right, from Marine Le Pen. Certainly we saw close ties between Donald Trump and UKIP. I know if Nigel, even though I know it's even divisive how Nigel, is it Farage or Farage? I know, however, everyone's arguing about he pronounces his name. But I wonder how much you think that Donald Trump, in to a certain extent, do you think that is an actual tie? Do you think that exists?
I think there certainly is a nationalist or super patriotic strain among at least a segment of Trump supporters. I think one thing we picked up during the primary season was that the Trump vote is kind of a mixed bag, but I think there certainly is that strain. I think even the slogan Make America Great Again speaks well to it, and the fact that it resonated the way it did, I think suggests that there's certainly that strain in his base of support.
Well, for me, my take is slightly different. Mm-hmm. For me, a nationalism is not the cause, it's the effect of something else. And the cause is globalization. I think people feel threatened, some segments of the population. They feel they've lost out to globalization. They think about their parents and grandparents who used to have stable careers in certain industries that do not exist anymore. They feel nobody is speaking up for them, so they feel threatened by globalization. And then on the other hand, there are people who have benefited from globalization because they have the kind of training, they know foreign languages, they have degrees that allow them to be mobile, to get good jobs in industries that are much more modern. And I think those people who are in the first category, the people who feel they have lost from globalization, they're the ones who turn to xenophobia and they turn to nationalism. I think it's a coping mechanism for people to think back to a time when things were better and they want to go back to that era. Now, we can talk about whether that's possible or not. That's why I think that the Trump voters are, as Shamira said, a mixed bag, is because you see different people who've lost to globalization for different reasons coming together. And I think Donald Trump did a very good job at understanding the concerns of those groups and expressing them during the campaign.
So when you say different ones, I wonder if anyone can weigh in here. When you say there are different reasons, I mean, certainly I have talked to and had a lot of people on my program saying, I lost a manufacturing job 20 years ago. I blame the Clintons for that. That's kind of the biggest one that comes to mind, I think, here in Illinois. What other, when you say there's sort of different reasons for sort of different ways that people you think would have supported Trump, what do you mean by that?
It's not just workers. So we tend to think of this group of workers who did manual jobs. But also there are, let's say there are farmers, for example, right? That's a different category. So it could be a very successful farmer, maybe not, that individual didn't travel very much, has not had a lot of contact with people from other countries. So for that person, seeing, for example, immigrants in his or her community, that may be threatening to them. They may think, these people are new. So that is not necessarily a person who is motivated by economic concerns, I don't have a job, but maybe their previous upbringing and cultural training has not prepared them to accept new people with new customs. So these are people who might find that, a much more xenophobic or nationalistic message resonates with them. So I think there are people who have economic motivations, people who have cultural motivations, and they are all represented by certain candidates.
Can I just add to that? I think this is also part of the story where people feel a little bit that they are no longer in control of their lives and of the environment they are in.
You're listening to a special broadcast of the 21st, recorded 2 days after the election in front of a University of Illinois audience for its European Union Center. Stay tuned. When we come back, we'll talk about what it means to be an American, a European, and you'll hear questions asked by our audience. Follow our Twitter handle, 21STShow, during the show. We live tweet out articles and other background information about what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, we're tweeting out the latest Illinois news. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to a special edition of the 21st. We recorded it live last Thursday in front of an audience as part of a program with the University of Illinois' European Union Center. We've been discussing the Trump presidency and its effect on Europe. I wanted to ask you about trade, and I actually had a farmer on my program before the election was over sharing his frustration he felt for the lack of substantive trade conversations that happened during the election. And I think I wonder if we could shift the conversation a little bit to what people understand about whether we're talking about, I feel like the TPP was sort of the biggest trade conversation that happened in this election. So let's start with that. Can we talk about the TPP and what you think, how you think that conversation happened during the election, if you think there was a lot of misinformation, or if there was a good understanding or good conversation about it?
I think trade is a difficult issue. It gets technical quickly. There's a lot of acronyms to keep track of, a lot of other countries to keep track of. And so I think that probably addresses why wasn't there very much substantive conversation about trade? It's a hard issue to talk about in the context of campaign soundbites and debates where you have 60 seconds to answer a question or you have 30 seconds to make your point in a commercial. Seized on the buzzwords and probably didn't have a very deep understanding of trade relationships. I think there's also a big appeal in, you don't like the way things are now and we've had these long-standing trade relationships through NATO or NAFTA or what have you. They're problematic. That's contributing to your circumstances. I'll renegotiate them. Right, there's a transactional solution that sounds straightforward, and I think that appealed to many voters.
What misunderstandings do you think there were? Do you think there were sort of, in this election, do you think there are things that you want to clear up about trade that you feel like you want to spend a minute and educate us on? I'm curious.
Educate, maybe not, but definitely trade and openness has been one of the hallmarks of the EU. You know, if you look at the figures for early this year, trade within the EU has been positive and has generated jobs, whereas trade outside the EU has contracted. So basically, EU citizens have benefited in the first part of this year in terms of job creation and wealth creation from trade amongst ourselves. So this has been positive. Also, if you look at trade, maybe just simply with the state of Illinois, there are businesses and European companies that do trade here and are creating jobs, not every day maybe, but on an ongoing basis. And that is very important at the state level and for our countries back in the EU. Trade is something that is essential to create more growth and prosperity for our citizens. This is really a matter of common and shared understanding between the EU and the US. We really fight for open markets amongst ourselves, and we'll definitely fight for the fact that trade is and remains fair between our two countries and globally. The EU and the US have always partnered in shaping standards globally, the rules of the game for world trade, and this is something that we will continue striving for in future.
Well, it's so interesting to hear you say that, because that's kind of the exact opposite of everything that we heard during the campaign, certainly from the Trump campaign. Costas, I wonder...
To me, this campaign was fascinating when it comes to the question of trade, not just because of that, but because I always thought it was the United States that promoted the World War II order. I mean, that's what we teach our students here, you know, with the Bretton Woods Agreement, the IMF, the World Trade Organization. So the United States is traditionally a big proponent of free trade. And in fact, one of the ways in which the U.S. is perceived in other countries as this very assertive power in favor of free trade. So seeing the two candidates of the two major parties in the United States taking positions that are anti-free trade was really fascinating to me. So the way I try to rationalize it, I try to interpret that, is that free trade has some good sides and has some bad sides. And the good side, you know, it can generate more growth, it can help economies grow, communities become more prosperous, countries become more prosperous because it creates a lot of new opportunities. But there are also people who lose from free trade, right? Because certain industries, when they're not competitive enough, they kind of wither away. Or, you know, certain operations or certain industries move to other countries where it makes more sense. And I think that's where the feelings of the electorate come in, because I think governments have not done a very good job protecting those parts of the population that have been negatively affected by free trade. So those farmers we're talking about, or the industrial workers, what potentially could happen in an alternative scenario would be governments would provide new opportunities for them, not necessarily bring the old jobs back, because that may not be possible, but help them retrain, perhaps, so they can get new jobs, or, you know, provide some type of economic assistance so they can stand on their feet and maybe they can find a new career. But I don't see, and I think especially in the United States, because of the way attitudes towards the welfare state have been shaped, I think it's politically not easy to do.
And Shamir, I wonder, as we think about, we've been spending so much time talking about Donald Trump winning, we haven't really talked about Republican control in Congress, both in the House and the Senate. And I wonder, as we look at that, where you see, as these agreements are being discussed and eventually ratified, where you think the tenor will be going in the next couple of months?
We haven't seen unified government, so Congress and the presidency controlled by the same party in a while. The Republican Party in Congress in recent years has been one that hasn't been very activist, even when they've had some opportunity to be. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how much rein they give to Trump. There will certainly be some initial legislative activity. I think things Republicans have been trying to do for years, like repeal the Affordable Care Act, for example. I think we'll see some quick action on that front. But when it comes to things that are going to take a bit longer, I mean, I think that's one of the big questions. The Republicans don't have a filibuster proof majority.
Yeah, here I would like to note that inaction is also action, right? So doing nothing is a way of doing something. And what I expect, at least until the next midterm elections, I think there are people in the Republican Party who understand the value of free trade, but because it's such a controversial issue, my expectation is that for the next 2 years, there won't be a lot of conversations about that in Congress. I could be wrong, of course. But
do you think there'll be a lot of conversations about immigration? Wonder what everyone's thoughts are on that.
I think we'll definitely see talk. Immigration and big immigration legislation happens rarely in the U.S.
Which is why we're in this
right. I mean,
position
the 1980s
that we're in right now.
Right. It's really the last time we saw big immigration policy making. And so it's an issue that resonates with the electorate on both sides. And so I expect we'll see congressmen doing things that they can claim credit for and that they can talk about back in their district. I don't know that we'll see that actually culminating in legislation or any sort of comprehensive immigration reform, at least not before 2018, before the midterm elections.
I wonder what you all think about the tone of, it was an interesting thing to me when we thought about how immigrants and refugees were sort of all put into the same conversation in this election. And it's a different conversation when you look at the American context of that versus the European one and the refugee crisis that's happening there. But I wonder who wants to kind of weigh in on their thoughts about COSAS?
So I think there is a difference between immigration and trade as issues. And again, that's just my opinion about these issues. But I think there are some objective differences. The Trump administration can afford to wait on trade and not do a lot because things can just continue the way they are. Even if he or, you know, the government doesn't decide to take any action on this. But with the case of immigration, it's a little different because there is constant movement of people. So they have to deal with that. There are people whose lives are affected by this policy. And I think what's interesting is that in the United States, immigration is a big electoral issue. It's an issue that can win votes on both on the Republican side and the Democratic side. So my sense is that, you know, Trump administration would like to make a move on that front. I don't think that the refugees are going to be such a big issue in the U.S. context as in the European context, because if we accept this legal division between migrants and refugees, so refugees fleeing political situations, migrants usually leave their home countries for economic reasons, I think the United States deal, and again, there's disagreement about whether it's a legitimate distinction, but legally they are different. And I think that the U.S. deals more with economic migrants, where government has more discretion to allow entry or not. While in Europe, the debate is mostly about refugees. And refugees are covered by a specific legal status. There is a convention, a United Nations convention, that ties the government's hands. And so they're dealing with the problem of refugees a little bit more complicated. What I'm trying to say is that here in the United States, for the Trump administration, it's easier to make a move and do something about immigration, since this immigration here involves primarily economic migrants, than for some European governments who have to deal with refugees primarily.
I wanted to ask all of you, and I want to ask particularly the two of you, Shamira and Costas, what kind of questions have your students come into class with this week? Because I imagine there's been a lot of conversation in class about the election and implications.
Of course, why were the polls wrong, and you know why didn't the media get this right? There's been a bit of that. In one of my classes, we've been studying voter turnout in particular, and so there have been a lot of questions about which demographics did and didn't turn out, whether things like states that allow for same-day registration, whether they saw higher or lower mm-hmm. voter turnout. A lot of that is still to be determined.
Was it a surprise to you that we saw, at least initially, that we're seeing that voter turnout was so low?
Yes, in part because if you look at a lot of local news stories during
well,
the
and
day,
early voting totals were so high.
Were so high. So early right. voting was high, and local news stories during the day and even into the evening were like, record voter turnout.
Well, I have
voter
to say, in my defense, high. That's exactly what all the clerks said to me.
Right.
So I asked yeah. them on the program, and they said, we're seeing record turnout. And so when the clerk yeah. of elections says that, that's kind of what you go with.
Yeah, and I think it only became clear later that voter turnout is actually down quite a bit from 2012 and 2008 for sure.
Mm-hmm. Costas, what about you in terms of questions?
I think this election has been good for teaching politics to students. because we can really illustrate certain things that they would normally hear and there's just yawn and, you know,
like what?
So one of the things that I've always tried to explain, which is one of the technical things about politics, is electoral rules and how they matter. And I'm sure, Shamira, you do that quite a bit. So having an electoral college versus having a proportional representation system versus having, you know, a majoritarian plurality system, so students really can understand exactly what that means and what implications it has. It's a point that's very difficult to make to students sometimes, is the symbolic aspect of politics. And that's what I get from the students. They try to understand, for example, why Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, why do they, people have reactions to them that are very emotional. I mean, usually most voters don't read all the details of their policy.
They're not
position.
Reading their positions on
right.
the TPP,
they
and
are,
that's
they,
determining
exactly,
how they're voting.
Right. So they are usually reacting emotionally to the candidates and to policies. And that's hard to explain. And I think that's something that people, because of these particular candidates, felt very often both of them were presented as caricatures. So they represented an emotional reaction, or they caused an emotional reaction. And so that's something that students, I hope, and some of them are in the audience, sort of understand. They begin to understand that institutions are important, policies are important, but there's this whole aspect, the more emotional side of politics, that's important.
Another set of questions I've been getting focuses more on what are the civil and human rights implications of this? And this is an unknown, but this is an election that we heard a lot about identity. All sorts of identities and what we're going to do with groups of people who are classified based on sexual orientation or race, ethnicity, religion. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty and some concern, right, about what does this election outcome mean for various civil rights protections that in some cases we've taken for granted for years now. And are we going to be seeing big policy changes, perhaps especially with changes in the Supreme Court?
Well, and I even think apart from policy changes, just individual expression, right? Mm-hmm. And I think we saw after Brexit, I saw a Guardian report about hate crimes and the rise. I think there was about a 30% increase in the immediate Brexit vote. And certainly we've seen in the past 24 hours across the U.S., even on this campus, different people expressing concern, saying that there have been racial attacks, there have been conversations, and I wonder how much that to. I'm curious your thoughts on, and Kostas, again, I guess maybe that's a little bit of a parallel I was thinking about as well between sort of an American Brexit, if this is an American Brexit or not. But I wonder what you all think about those social and cultural implications of, and I think you're right, Shamira, it is around identity, right? And I guess the question I would want to ask all of you guys is, ultimately, are we facing questions of who's an American or who's a European? Do you think that's really what we're really talking about here?
Well, what's interesting is when a campaign or an election revolves around identity, it becomes very personal. Because identity is not like an economic issue, it's not a trade issue, it's something personal. We have identities, and different people have different identities. So when identity, whether somebody is African-American or a woman or, you know, Muslim, when that becomes part of a campaign, that becomes personal to the person who, to the voter. And so then the reaction is also personal, and it's... there's something about, and I think that has something to do with the reaction to immigration. It humanizes politics in a way, and we tend to think of it as having a good effect, but sometimes it can have what we would call a negative effect, because we can be both nice to other human beings, but also we feel comfortable being not nice to other human beings. And so when there are questions of identity, and I'm thinking about my identity against somebody else's, that becomes very personal, and because the recipient of my admiration or hatred is another person, I can express it more easily than if I'm dealing with a corporation or with an abstract trade issue. So I think that's what, to me, explains this record. So if it was just about trade, I wouldn't expect these personal attacks. But because identity was such a big part of the campaign, that's what causes this reaction.
Coming up, we wrap up our conversation with the European Union Center and take questions from our live audience that ended our special event last week. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to a special edition of The 21st. We recorded it live last Thursday in front of an audience as part of a program with the University of Illinois's European Union Center. We talked about the effect of the American election on European politics and the global economy. And as we wrapped up our discussion, we took questions from our audience.
One of the questions that's been on my mind is how the image of Americans will be affected by that, specifically in Europe. Because I remember the time when Barack Obama was elected, and that really, you know, like the Americans as people has, you know, become more popular, especially in certain parts of the world. Do you think, you know, now we will see a reverse reaction, a different reaction?
The image of America, it's a long-standing image of a friend and a partner. And this friendship and this partnership, it will last. We have seen changes in governments in the U.S. Throughout the past years. Governments have changed also in Europe. Different countries of Europe make for a whole set of governmental relationships or institutional relationships with the U.S. And that, you know, doesn't alter the nature of our friendship and partnership with the American people. Maybe it brings an opportunity for Europe to be more united in the face of this election, also show that we're able to play the role of a partner which is more united and will be more vocal on certain issues, that we can come together in a stronger way, and that we will have an institutional relationship which is stronger with the new administration. But the image and the long-lasting relationship between the two partners will remain.
I think there is always an interesting relationship American presidents have with global citizens, right? And we look at the immense popularity that Barack Obama enjoyed outside the U.S. And I think that's probably part of the question as well, is how is everybody looking at Donald Trump now?
People pay a lot of attention to the U.S. in Europe, more, I think, so than Americans pay attention to individual European countries. And that's because the U.S. is a big power, and people are aware that decisions that are made by the United States will have an effect, not just for Europe, but for the rest of the world. But I think we need to separate sort of the long-term image of the United States and sort of the fluctuation that we see whenever the administration is different. So I grew up in Greece, and I know a lot of people in Europe, and I feel that a lot of people in Europe, they understand that Americans do politics differently. So they all understand that. Right? They're very distinctive. It's a very distinctive kind of politics, right? They can't really describe what's different, but they know what's different.
And then, so then what are they saying about this election then?
So that's part of that. So there is a certain weirdness. If you look at it from a European perspective, the whole campaigning and the style of the campaign.
And how long it is.
Well, now it's been longer. It's becoming longer and longer, but generally the overall, sort of the how personal the campaigns are, because the campaigns revolve around candidates for president. Parties do play an important role, but not as important a role as in European elections, where parties are really traditionally much more important than the individual candidates. So there is this personal aspect that I think is very intriguing and fascinating for a European audience. But then, of course, there are going to be changes in the way they see particular candidates. So I think a lot of people in Europe right now are surprised. I think, like the experts we talked about in the beginning, a lot of people in many European countries, including not just the elites, but also the citizens, they thought that Hillary Clinton would probably win the election. So I suspect they're very surprised. But overall, I think people admire the democracy in the U.S., but they understand that it has its own sort of distinctive characteristics.
Do you think this election has changed that opinion?
I don't know yet. We'll have to wait. It depends on what President Trump does and how he, you know, what kind of policies he represents.
Do you think that, like, with Donald Trump and Brexit, do you think that this will, like, signal a more of a decline in the Anglo-American dominance of world politics?
I'm not sure there is an Anglo-American dominance of world politics. I understand it as there is a special relationship between the two countries, so that's whenever I hear diplomats from Washington, D.C., from the embassy of the United Kingdom talk about U.S.-UK relations, they talk about the special relationship. I don't know what is going to happen to it. My sense is that from the U.K. side, I anticipate that the U.K. will want stronger relations with the United States because it's cutting its ties, or the ties that it already has with the continent.
It's interesting. I was trying to find the email from the British government that they sent because I wanted to count how many times the word special was used today in the release that was sent out between what the conversation that happened between Theresa May and Donald Trump. I felt like the word special was used even more than the normal amount of times Donald Trump uses special. So,
Did you want to answer, Valerie?
Yeah, just a word about the relationship between the EU and the US. Indeed, I mean, you bring up the fact that the EU and its member states, in their diversity, have relations with the US in a bilateral way as well, and that will necessarily continue. Yet, I think it's probably the time now for the EU to step up and increase its role in the bilateral relationship with the US, and will probably work to play a more unifying role in this respect.
I was hoping to talk about the Paris Agreement passed earlier this year. The UN deal passed with over 100 signatories and got China, India, and the United States to sign on about putting down global emissions. President Trump has in the past talked about climate change being a so-called Chinese hoax. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on what effect leaving the deal would have on relations with EU members and perhaps on the deal itself.
That's a very good point. I mean, from an EU perspective, the three domains that we will watch closely going forward are definitely climate change, trade, and the international order or global security, and our partnership with the US, you know, on other matters that relate to security. And definitely climate change is one of the top priorities. We will continue to foster the implementation of this deal and to push for results to be achieved through this deal. And as far as the positions that have been taken during the campaign are concerned, we really have to see how this will play out. Again, this is an area where we are going to closely monitor what the developments are domestically and how this will play out in the political system. I think it's a bit early to draw conclusions right now, but this is definitely very important to us.
Since I'm not a diplomat, I don't feel like I need to answer diplomatically. And I think as far as I'm concerned, I don't expect anything to happen with the Paris Agreement under these circumstances. This is the Kyoto Protocol all over again as far as I'm concerned. The only thing that's different this time, I think, is China is on board. And that's what might tip the balance, might convince the Trump administration to ratify. So my understanding is this agreement has still not been voted on in the Senate, in the U.S. Senate. I don't see how a Republican majority is going to approve this agreement, the Paris Agreement. So I don't expect any movement on this unless, you know, China pulls some levers or there's some external reason for doing that.
One thing we haven't talked about is the upcoming elections that we're going to be seeing in Europe. And I think if we've learned anything from this conversation, it's that certainly as a member of the media, I'm not going to predict anything, and we're not going to think about polling. But I do wonder now that we have seen these two important results, what we think the implications are for as we think about, I think the Dutch vote is first and then Germany. Is that the correct order? Am I in the wrong order?
You have the first being the Dutch vote in March.
In March.
Then you have the upcoming French election starting end of April and finishing in May. And then the German election in September of next year.
Mm-hmm. That said, thoughts? Does anyone want to weigh in on where, obviously, those are three very specific. Those are, again, if we think about all politics being local, those are all going to be, those are three completely different elections. But I wonder if we see any implications.
So I think there is a trend that I'm interested in seeing how true it is or how much it continues. I think one of the things that defines our political era is, you know, the rise of populist movements and populist parties. Whether they're on the left or on the right, because we've talked about right-wing populism a bit, but there is also left-wing populism. So for me, it's interesting that traditional politics or the political establishment is not doing very well, not just here in the United States, but also in European countries. So I'm aware of populist right-wing parties that have gained strength in Sweden, in Denmark, in Finland, in the Netherlands, definitely, in France. And so this is a trend. And what's interesting to me, and I want to see how much of that will happen, is they feed off each other. That's my sense anyway. So the Brexit vote happens first, so a populist movement wins. And that encourages a populist movement in the United States. And then that could potentially encourage a populist movement in France. Again, that's a theory. We'll have to see if that is actually going to happen. But I'm curious to see if that's actually happening and if there is some causal effect where, you know, Marine Le Pen, I could imagine 5 years ago, she could be dismissed as somebody who is not part of the establishment and she will never have a chance of governing. But now Donald Trump won and he was not part of the establishment. Brexit happened and nobody thought it was possible. So maybe a Marine Le Pen presidency in France is also possible. That's something I want to see if that's a trend that continues, or if it's just, if there's isolated cases of anti-establishment movements.
It's interesting that you use it. Why do you use the term populist instead of nationalist?
I think of populist movements as movements that are responsive to certain citizen concerns, and, you know, they kind of make promises that sound good to certain members of the electorate, but I'm not sure how realistic the implementation of those promises are. There are populist movements on the left and populist movements on the right. That's how I understand it. So nationalism can be part of a populist movement on the right, but not necessarily on the left.
Mm. Shamira, what do you think about implications if you, maybe even if you don't want to do political economic, I'm just curious.
I can see, especially Brexit first, U.S., an emboldening of populist movements, of the anti-establishment, especially when you're like, this wasn't possible, right? It's always an establishment candidate who wins. And we saw the opposite happen. I could see that being inspiring to some and emboldening.
I think one big takeaway and one that I think is worth bearing in mind in the coming months is just how many moving parts there are in politics. And Trump is one person who said a lot of things on the campaign trail. And he's going to be taking a position in a government of hundreds. Yes, he'll be the president, the chief executive, but he has to work with a Congress. There's a big bureaucracy that he said very little about. There's always an election in the United States, right? We're, you know, we'll be looking at the midterms probably starting in the next few days. And so I think with all these moving parts, I think there's just so much uncertainty coming up and a lot to watch. I'd be wary of assuming anything at this point.
To me, the story of this election is a story of political communication. That's what, to me, it all comes down to. The old ways of communicating with the voters have changed. And if there's anything I've learned from the Trump campaign, is that you need to have really good people who can convey your message, you know, in a way that resonates with the voters. The use of Twitter, the use of online platforms for communication. To me, what's interesting is that the Clinton campaign had a very, very sophisticated organization with volunteers, people on the ground, a lot of money. The Clinton campaign was endorsed by most newspapers in the country, so they had all the traditional support any candidate could imagine. But Donald Trump's campaign was able to navigate these new media, reach out to the voters. The Trump campaign didn't need any of the traditional ways of political communication because they had new ones. And it was much cheaper to do that. So he did all that with a fraction of the funds that Hillary Clinton used. And so for me, what I expect to see in future elections is that candidates trying to imitate that strategy in the future.
Really, and not any different than what Barack Obama did with social media and fundraising 8 years ago, in a way. You think so? Oh, Valerie, you disagree.
Yeah, I think the tone of this campaign was really what changed the communication, the divisiveness of the debates, the language, etc. And this really resonated differently with people, and you talked about making it more personal. But the drawback is, I think, really that it has made it more divisive, and I'm wondering, you know, what impact this has on the way that people will think of their community. How do you reunite people after such a divisive campaign? I'm not sure, and that is to be seen. So I'm hoping that all this very high-powered rhetoric will calm down, and that you know, people will get to work on the issues that people are worried about and work on the fears of people to try to better understand them and transform this into a very determined policy agenda to make these people feel better about the society we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much to our guests. I want to thank Valerie Wuchsel-Lexton with the EU delegation, Head of Economic and Financial Affairs, Kostas Kourtikakis, is I say that? I did not say that correct, did I?
I did. Great. An associate professor of political science at the University of Illinois, and Shamira Gelpman, who is at Wabash College in Indiana, both of you political science professors. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That does it for our special edition of today's 21st, thanks to the European Union Center at the University of Illinois. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking with the Police Training Institute's Michael Schlosser. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.